This is the New World Report with Professor Evan Ellis of the U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute. We follow the news from Reuters. Secretary of State Antony Blinken heads to Latin America. He's on his way. He's there now to reassert Washington's commitment to the region and meet with three new leftist leaders. This is Reuters copy. Amid concerns the neglect of the hemisphere has let China make economic roads. This is the secretary heading to the Organization of American States meeting in Lima, Peru. But on his way, he's meeting in Colombia, I believe, and then Chile, and then in Lima with the presidents of these states. So before we plunge into the details of Gustavo Petro and Antony Blinken, what is the Organization of American States today, Evan? It was very popular, much spoken of, at the turn of the 20th century, probably to do with the Panama Canal ambition by Theodore Roosevelt. But in any event, during the 20th century, it was a sidebar of sidebar for the foreign policy of the U.S. What is it today that they want to revive? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Well, the Organization of American States really came out of a spirit of Pan-Americanism that started, as you alluded to, the last century and continued to evolve. And if you go back farther, you find leaders such as the much mentioned Simon Bolivar with that dream of Pan-Americanism, at least focused on the Spanish-speaking, or to a certain extent, the Spanish-speaking and the Portuguese-speaking states. But the concept of Pan-Americanism that incorporated the OAS, and you mentioned Teddy Roosevelt, was this idea that the United States, also a former colony, is part of the Americas. We all share a certain common destiny, despite the fact that some of us speak English, some of us speak Portuguese, some of us speak, some of us speak Spanish, some of us speak Dutch. We oftentimes forget Suriname, for example. But the OAS, especially during the Cold War, took on a certain importance because with the heavy U.S. influence in the hemisphere, it was a way also to try to bring the hemisphere together with a certain leadership role also for the United States. And so today, as we look at other alternative multilateral bodies, so for example, Hugo Chavez and previously Lula, among others, created this alternative that came out of other institutions called CELAC, which is essentially all of the countries in the region, but excluding the United States and Canada and those states that don't have full foreign policy sovereignty. So the OAS in many ways represents a concept of Pan-Americanism. We're all in this together, but with the with the U.S. having a key role. And of course, the OAS headquarters is situated right there in Washington, D.C. Having said that, in recent years, you've had the symbolism of the Summit of the Americas coming out of the OAS and the Inter-American System, the idea of let's all come together. And the recent debates that we saw at the recent Summit of the Americas of, is it right to exclude some countries just because they happen to be non-democratic when we all agreed that we were coming together as a group of democracies? Really part of the challenge right now for the OAS is that with the turn to the left in the region, and although it's a variety of different actors, there are many different voices who would prefer to minimize the U.S. role. And we can also remember that in previous years, when the majority of the states in the region were more of a conservative bent, voices such as the current OAS head, Luis Almagro, were advocates for essentially restoration of democracy in places like Nicaragua and in places like Venezuela. And so really the ability of the OAS as the premier multilateral organization with a permanent secretariat and frankly, with a variety of supporting institutions, including human rights institutions in which the U.S. have a role. That future, as opposed to futures where the U.S. does not have a seat at the table, is really at stake. And so, making this OAS meeting productive is a key part, I think, of the visit of Secretary Blinken to Colombia, Chile, and Peru, where the OAS meeting will occur among other parts of his visit.
We have a quote, thanks to Reuters, from Assistant Secretary Brian Nichols. We are not judging, speaking for the State Department, we are not judging countries based on where they fall on the political spectrum, but rather their commitment to democracy, the rule of law, and human rights. So this is an engagement with three recently elected presidents, Gustavo Petro in Colombia, Gabriel Boric in Chile, and Castillo, President Castillo in Peru. However, the question of Gustavo Petro comes up first because of the meeting and also because of Petro reaching out not only to Maduro, whom the State Department regards as illegitimate, we just discussed Venezuela, but also because the Gustavo Petro government seems to be opening endless discussions with the ELN, a narco-terrorist gang that heretofore has been a threat to the United States. Now, I understand and you do diplomacy with your adversaries, not with your friends, although sometimes that's useful. What is it that the U.S. needs to establish Colombia with Colombia that hasn't existed heretofore with Petro? Because Colombia, I've long been led to believe, is our strongest ally in South America. Is that in question now?
Well, John, I'm fascinated by the strategic tact that appears to me that Secretary Blinken and Brian Nichols, who I've interacted with and just have enormous respect for, I'm fascinated by the tact that they seem to be taking with this very difficult challenge. First of all, I should point out that one thing that's given me a certain amount of hope is to see that the level of engagement in recent weeks on Latin America has been pretty significant. So in addition to this trip, for example, you actually had the head of SOUTHCOM, General Richardson, recently in Ecuador for a military conference that brought a big part of the region together. You had a very important meeting in Mexico discussing U.S.-Mexican relations. You have also an engagement, which is a follow-up of the Summit of the Americas, talking about migration issues. And so on top of all of those different pieces, you now have this Blinken trip. And to me, what the administration seems to be trying to do is to try to minimize the impact of differences. Indeed, some of the UN speeches, and certainly Petro's UN speech, essentially, rejecting the U.S.-led war on drugs and the whole approach, really, that the U.S. had taken to Colombian security relations in general. It's striking that despite all of that and despite some of the other proclamations at the UN, Blinken seems to be choosing, and Nichols seems to be choosing to not focus on that, but try to say, hey, we can work with you. We understand where you're coming from, a holistic approach to drugs. We can all be friends here. And to me, the key that you pointed out to is, I think, where the administration seems to be going, which is that the focus is going to be not convergence on policy issues or security cooperation, as we've had before, because they clearly know that that is really unlikely right now. But the new yardstick seems to be what things that are of emphasis to the Biden administration, human rights, democracy, and things like this. And so to me, that seems to be the new litmus test as the administration tries to, ignore the pig in the room and to find new sources of common ground where we can work with these very ideologically different regimes.
And on to Chile. Santiago, a very young man, serious-minded. I watch his speeches. I don't have the Spanish, but he's very serious face when he talks to the Chilean peoples. Rejected the Constitution some weeks past, a Constitution he vouchsafed for. That would seem, of these three countries, Evan, that would seem to be the most likely for Secretary Blinken to make headway. Because Gabriel Boric is a young man learning to be the president of a major country. He has natural resources aplenty, and the writing of the Constitution is a demonstration of democracy if we presume it was not a predicate to doing away with elections, and as it's been in other countries. So do you agree that Chile is fertile ground for the message of democracy and fair-mindedness?
Well, certainly, John, I think that if there's any country that is amenable to this new approach the Biden administration seems to be pursuing, it's Chile, because, as you pointed out, on the one hand, Boric has not done himself any favors politically. He, his constitution and the relatively disorganized way that this, the Constituent Assembly wrote it and what came out about it, that went very badly. Some of his security policies and his early ministers have gone very badly. Some of his pronouncements on economic issues and tax issues have a lot of people spooked in Chile. And yet, despite all that, it does seem that the young President Boric has a strong principled commitment to democracy. We've seen him speak out very critically about Nicolas Maduro and the Ortegas in Nicaragua and others, things that actually earned him the reprobation of those leaders in recent days. To the extent that it's saying that, you know, despite things that may cause concern about where Chile is going or his own political fortunes, there's, I think, a recognition that it might be unadvisable policies, but they seem to be a sincere commitment to democratic practices. And it appears that that tends to be something that the Biden administration believes that they can work with as a basis for continuing a positive relationship as we move forward with Chile.
And on to Pedro Castillo in Lima, where the OAS is meeting. Peru is a vital, needful country. The food security, which is bad throughout Latin America, we talked about it last time. From reporting in Peru, they were badly damaged by the pandemic. They could use everything. Is the U.S. in a position to help them?
Very little at this point, John. It's fascinating. There was a great article that came out talking about the remarkable stability in Peru's ongoing instability. As we've talked about, Peru has gone through now 76 different cabinet ministers. And in 4 months, you have six separate sets of charges against Pedro Castillo. His own daughter is in jail. His nephew has been on the run. And you have a Congress which has been largely discredited, which is trying to regain its credibility. And yet, despite all of that, and despite the fact that you have 76% informality in Peru, the overall GDP figures seem to show up relatively well. And so what you really have is you have economic success alongside a just abject poverty and inequality. And yet people can point to some things in the past, such as relatively responsible fiscal policies, relatively responsible monetary policies, relative opening up of extractive sectors like mining, which go all the way back to people like Alberto Fujimori, as a number of my colleagues have pointed out about. But at the end of the day, there are some significant, essentially structural reforms that Peru needs in terms of social justice and systems, as well as, frankly, needing continued high prices for the commodities. I think the United States can play a part of the solution to helping strengthen Peru's institutions. The question of political stability, which has to do with Peru's sovereignty, and the question of long-term reform, that's something that that Peru right now needs to work out largely with itself right now. But you're also absolutely right that these issues of food insecurity, which also affects a third of the Brazilian population and a number of others, especially with Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the enormously inflationary effect that that's had on basic food prices as well as oil prices. That's something that's having political ripple effects. We're seeing most in Peru, but we're seeing it also causing instability and concerns really throughout the region in Panama, in Ecuador in recent weeks, just to name a couple.
Yes, I mentioned food security because last week we noted that President Castillo had been flippant about fertilizer, the lack of fertilizer throughout the continent. But also in Peru, saying we didn't use fertilizer, referring to his home in the north. I've done reporting on fertilizer now, Evan, and the situation grows much worse in 23. The ammonia nitrate fertilizer, the phosphate base, the potash base, none of it's coming out sufficiently to help Latin America. So food security will be a major focus, especially in Peru. Just finally, the Reuters uses the word leftist, and I don't object to that. But these are three different varieties of leftists. Gustavo Petro is a sophisticated actor, longstanding in the Senate in Bogota, a political professional. Gabriel Boric is a classical Marxist scholar. And Pedro Castillo is a former teacher with very little training in politics whatsoever. To group them all as leftists seems inarticulate. Am I correct in that this is not a fair-minded summary of who they are?
Absolutely, John. The part of the challenge is realizing that each of these leaders are very different, and those in turn are very different than the populist authoritarian that in cynical ways have hijacked and continue to exploit countries like Venezuela or Nicaragua. The thing that concerns me, however, is that for very different reasons, in situations of very tight fiscal conditions, weakened economies, that the policies across the region are taking each of those countries in some very risky areas of concern. So the concern is whether, for cynical reasons or elsewhere, the increase that could possibly occur in criminality and insecurity because of some of Petro's proposed policies in Colombia, just as some of the policies that could scare investors could lead Boric's minority coalition to find itself in very difficult situations fiscally in Chile. And of course, Peru, with the ongoing instability that could lead to more churn and even the ouster of Castillo himself. And so each one of those states seems to be on different tracks, but each of those tracks has the risk of leading to political and economic instability and polarization that could lead to even more extreme political solutions that could lead to even graver difficulties in the region to which we are connected by ties of geography and commerce and frankly, family.
Professor Avenelis, U.S. Army War College. We're going to Uruguay next because I know very little, almost nothing, except for Montevideo and the teachers here to instruct me on my first lesson. This is the New World Report. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.